So I am here today with Dr. Mahindrajeet Singh. And first of all, thank you very much for agreeing to an interview. And I'm just interested in your role right now and where you work, please.
Okay, so thanks for this interview. I work with Institute for Plasma Research.
Yes.
Specifically working for ITER India.
Yes.
And heading the Diagnostic Neutral Beam Group.
Okay.
Which is a part of the procurement package which India has to deliver to ITER.
Okay, to ITER, and that's the International Fusion Project. It's sort of like the CERN of fusion, I suppose.
Correct. So yes. ITER is an international project. So a lot of countries are contributing both in cash and in kind.
Okay.
So in-kind procurements are designated to different countries, which is basically supplying the components to ITER. And these components then will form a part of machine.
Okay.
So, for example, India has 9 such deliverables to ITER.
Okay.
They start with the cryostat, which is the outer case of the machine.
Right.
Then we have some cooling systems which are water cooling systems.
Okay.
Then we have the cryogenic lines and the cryodistribution system for transporting the cryogen from the main cryo plant to the various systems where they are required.
Okay.
Then we have EC heating systems, IC heating systems.
Okay.
And
what does EC and IC stand for?
So EC is like electron cyclotron heating system.
Okay. Ah, right.
And IC is like ion cyclotron heating system.
Okay. Yes.
And
I see what you mean.
Then we have the diagnostic neutral beam.
Yeah.
Which is basically a 100 kV beam to be used as.
And is that a deuteron beam or a hydrogen beam?
It's a hydrogen beam.
Okay. Yes.
And it will be used for diagnosing the helium ash mm-hmm. during the DT phase of the plasma.
Okay.
And then we have a power supply group which is supposed to deliver power supplies for the EC, IC, and the diagnostic neutral beam.
Okay. Wow. So quite a large set of equipment and technology from the India side. And where is your lab located in India, if you don't mind explaining?
So our lab is located in a state called Gujarat.
Okay.
And the city name is Ahmedabad.
Mm-hmm.
So the lab is located on the border of Ahmedabad and Gandhinagar.
Okay. And the acronym, that's the IPR?
It's called the Institute for Plasma
Research. Yes, okay.
Yeah, and ITER India is a special project in Institute for Plasma Research, which is dedicated to, which is basically the nodal center for our interactions with ITER and also for ensuring that the in-kind contributions are made.
And do you have an official title with regards to that exactly? Like, is there... Like if you had a business card.
I am basically right now Associate Project Director.
Yes.
For ITER India.
Okay.
And that's my title. And in Academy Award, I'm a Senior Professor.
Okay. Oh, interesting. And also, I'm just wondering where, the city where ITER India IPR is located. How far is that from Delhi? Which direction and how far from Delhi, for example?
Delhi is sort of central part of
India, yes.
And you will fly west when you go there.
Okay.
So it's about an hour and 10 minutes
flight. So is that like, I don't know,
so that's
300 miles or 800 miles?
I can say...
Or of kilometers?
In kilometers, it will be roughly around, let's say, 12 to 1400
kilometers. Okay. Well, it's quite a ways. Okay.
So it's a night's train journey.
Okay. Did you grow up from that region or did you come from somewhere else in India?
No, I was born in a state which is called Uttar Pradesh.
Yes.
And I graduated, I did my master's in physics from Lucknow University.
Yes.
And then for my PhD, I worked at Nuclear Science Center, which is nowadays called IUAC, Inter-University Accelerator Center.
Where is that?
So that
oh,
is
that
Delhi.
In, that oh, that's in Delhi. Delhi. Okay.
Right? So... Inter-University Accelerator Center is like a multi-user facility where students from various universities go and do their experiments.
Yes.
So I was doing the atomic physics experiments, specifically the ion atom collision part of it, looking into direct ionization, electron capture, electron loss processes.
Okay.
For heavy ion beams interacting with gas targets, something which you saw in the talk today, which was where the ion beams have been replaced by lasers.
Yes.
So that was the kind of studies which I did for my PhD.
Okay.
And then after my PhD, I became a postdoc at Institute for Plasma Research for 6 months.
Yes.
And then moved on to US as a postdoc for 2 years.
Oh, where? What lab?
I was in a postdoc in J.R. McDonnell Laboratory, Kansas State University.
Okay.
Huh. So I was there for 2 years, and then I came back and joined Institute for Plasma Research again because... So because of the challenging projects and related to fusion, systems are large and huge.
Yes.
And one of the things which...
And a lot of money involved, really.
Well,
you know.
Yes, money is part of it because if you're developing something big, then obviously you need money for that. But my interest was more from the fact that I was motivated by one of the things which my professor said, that once you are a PhD, then you are trained to enter into any field you like. You should enjoy doing that, and you should not be, the more you make yourself uncomfortable by entering new fields, the more you'll progress academically.
Oh, I like that tip.
I followed that advice.
Yes.
And that's how I took up Institute for Plasma Research.
And if I may just interrupt, and your master's, what did you do there just before your PhD?
So I was master's in physics.
Yes.
And specializing in electronics.
Oh, really? So that, again, that was different. Right. Again. Yeah.
Right. So master's in physics, specializing in electronics.
Yeah.
PhD in atomic physics and working in nuclear fusion.
Okay. That's like your professor said, you're investigating a few different areas. And I think it's nice, because then often you can do lateral kind of thinking in the sense that, I learned some tricks or techniques over here, and in this area they don't really know about it, and you can bring it over if it's useful.
That is correct. So the major advantage of working interdisciplinary is that you learn to how to correlate various things.
You know,
what you have learned or where you can invest, or where you can make the things better, or how you would design new systems for larger, which are larger than what you have worked upon.
Yeah.
So this is the biggest advantage I have seen being cross-disciplinary, is that you get exposure in different fields, and at the same time you learn the art of correlating your learnings to different fields at a very different pace than what you would if you were confined to a single.
I'm going to switch topics slightly again, and now we are at the International Conference on Ion Sources right now in Oxford, England, and it's a very enjoyable conference for both of us, and and we're here in early September 2025, and wondering what you think of the conference, what are some aspects that are interesting for Hugh, maybe one or two anecdotally for you that you are kind of found interesting or special at this point.
So as I told you, I love to be cross-disciplinary, interdisciplinary. And this conference is actually interdisciplinary because it has two major projections. One is the physics and the technology, which is related to the accelerators.
Yes.
And one is the physics and technology, which is related to nuclear fusion.
Fusion, okay.
So, since I have worked with accelerators for my PhD, so my interest in accelerators always has been there. And when I attend these conferences, I get to know the latest developments which are happening worldwide, so it gives me a good platform for that. And at the same time, I'm able to communicate to the community what we are doing in terms of nuclear fusion.
Right.
So it also helps me to let people know from the accelerator world, because the two words are completely different. I mean, you talk about accelerators, you talk about very high energies, MeVs, TeVs, GeVs, whatever. But you talk of tiny currents like microamperes or milliamperes.
That's right.
That. But in fusion, we are just the opposite.
Yeah.
So we talk about 100 kV beams, but we are talking about currents which are in amperes.
Amps. So
you're transiting from a milliamp kind of a thing to an amp kind of a thing. So the whole scale of doing things changes.
Yeah.
The physics is the same, of course, for producing ions and stuff like that. But the way you utilize for a specific application is something which you learn when you compare the two words.
Yes, and a couple of examples that we can look at, and even in terms of beam size, the cross section of the beam, many of the beams that I have used are, say, on the order of 1 centimeter in diameter. You're talking about beams that are almost a meter in diameter, or half a meter, but quite large.
We are talking about beams which are quite large as compared to accelerators, but the other important thing which makes these beams different from the accelerators is that In accelerators, you can always control the beam as it is flowing through the path.
True,
you have quadrupoles here,
yes,
dipoles,
but you don't.
But we don't. We have to rely on our design abilities for the single extractor accelerator
right.
system, and so, that is going to ensure the whole transport.
Right. So basically, the parameters you can adjust within the plasma or within, as you say, the extraction grids,
right.
And that's that.
That's
after
it.
That, and then often you're converting those. You know, let's say it's H plus or D plus or something, you are neutralizing those, or it could be H minus or D minus and you're neutralizing those, and now you've got a neutral beam. So it's like an atomic beam going forward. And that also, to me, I find for some reason exciting and interesting that you've got this neutral beam because it's neutral, it can get through the magnetic fields to get into a tokamak, say. And so...
But this is a completely different ball game, because when you start playing with different species in the beams, especially the neutral beams, then even after you have utilized a gas cell to neutralize the beam, so, and there are certain neutralization efficiencies depending on various aspects of the energy and target densities and stuff like that. But you always, because you can never have a perfect vacuum, these neutrals that you have created, they are going to again interact with the backgrounds and become ions again.
Right.
You know?
Good point. Yes.
So that brings in a new challenge to the whole beam transport learning and studies related to this. And so for example, even if you would say that, okay, I have a neutralizer cell where I produce 60%, convert 60% of the ions into neutrals, and I have 40% ions which are there, which I will separate it out using my ion deflection system.
Yes.
And 60 amps would be flowing down.
Yeah.
60% of that 60 amps will be flowing down.
Yeah.
But then there is never a perfect vacuum, so you will definitely lose that.
And you'll start to create some more ions again.
And then the other thing is that because you do not have any ways to control the beam in terms of its blow up,
right.
So you can also end up having direct interception losses of the beam.
Right.
So there are several different aspects of the whole beam technology when it comes to neutral beams.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, so I mean, I tried to draw a comparison between an accelerator and a fusion reactor. So I mean, you get exposed to various worlds, you learn what is going on, you exchange ideas with people where somebody who has worked something on the accelerator may be useful for the fusion community as well, and something which we have learned, we also try to pass on to them. So it becomes a very interactive, good platform for these kind of conferences. Mm-hmm. That is why I love it.
Yeah, and I've just got a couple more questions. So one is actually on that cultural aspect. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, obviously we are seeing people give all kinds of different talks, so we're exposed to this diverse technologies and ideas, so sometimes we can find a new one we can apply to our own area. But also I find that, you know, these conferences are all over the world, and then right, so even culturally what you eat is different. Like here we can have, like, I've noticed there's like, you know, like a kind of a pork pie in the pub or something that might be, you know, maybe something from England you can eat. And I'm kind of wondering, in your area of India, is there a particular dish that is popular in, like, where your IPR lab is, for example? Like, what?
Well, India, because it is culturally very diverse,
yes.
So every state of India has its own speciality when it comes to food.
Yeah, but how about where the IPR is, for example?
So, for example, where IPR is, we are in Gujarat, so the food is, if you look at traditional food, it would be a Gujarati food,
yes.
Which would taste different than the food from where I come from.
Right.
You know, and it will taste different from the food from, if somebody comes in from Delhi.
Yes, but what is in the, can you just describe, like, a dish from Gujarat? Just one dish,
so,
like,
Gujarat,
I'm interested.
For example, in snacks, if you look at it, there is something called dhokla or fafda,
okay.
Things like that, which you don't see, which when I was growing up in the north part of India, I never got got to taste them.
Yeah.
But I, first time I saw it is in Gujarat now. But nowadays, because there's a lot of openness in terms of cuisines, and because of the internet as well, so you started getting these things in different places as well.
Yeah.
But then the traditional is traditional. I mean,
yeah.
What is good in Gujarat, I mean, if you're typically looking for a dish from Gujarat,
yes.
It will taste best in Gujarat. Only.
Right. But can you describe it to me? Because I don't know. So can you just describe one? Does it have rice in it or curry?
Fafda is something which is made out of floor made out of black grams.
Oh, okay.
Right, and then you you sort of knead it, and then you make very thin strips out of it.
Okay.
And then you deep fry it.
Okay.
And then you while you're kneading it, you add different kinds of spices to that to make it more flavorful.
Okay.
So that is something which is very particular. I mean, very typical of a.
And is it crunchy after?
It is crunchy.
Ah, okay. Okay. Thank you.
Are different chutneys which are made. For example, you make a chutney out of raw papaya.
Yeah.
And you eat it with fafda, and then you have some onions and all that. So it tastes very different than the food which you eat in the western part of the world.
Right.
So yeah, I mean.
And I quite like experimenting. Like again, we go to the conference. I've been to, for example, a conference in Indore in India.
So Indore, you would have enjoyed the poha. So poha is something which is made out of rice flakes, and you add spices and it is dry, but it goes very well with tea.
Okay.
So that's a specialty of that region. Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, if you would have gotten the chance to taste these Gujarati dishes had you been in the part of last year. Okay, so you missed it. Next time you come, we can guide you there.
Yeah, I would love to. It's now I'm like for myself. I traveled so much up until COVID. Like even that year, I had 17 international trips. It's it starts to affect my health, so I can't go to everything now. But my last question is related to, it's really pouring rain here. It's interesting. The question is related to, is there something from your childhood? Like if you were, say, you know, yourself as 5 years old or maybe 10 years old, that you can see something of your character then that you still have now. Can you see something of your little self that you still is in you as you are doing your job now or how you are now?
Right. So there's a word called curiosity which has always remained in me from my childhood to now, and probably that is the one which made me interested in the field of research also. I mean, I come from a family of scientists.
Oh, really?
My dad was a scientist, my grandfather was a scientist.
Interesting.
And so they were chemists.
Okay.
I chose physics because, I mean, I was, I don't know, I liked it very much, and so I took up physics and then took up research in physics. And my daughter, again, is becoming a third generation chemist, so she is.
Wow, but there's actually, that's like four generations. Your grandfather, father, yourself, and your daughter are scientists. That's pretty rare.
My main motivation for becoming a scientist was from the fact that I used to see my father, who was a very hardworking fellow, and he was very excited when he would find something new on what he was working on, and the kind of satisfaction it used to give him.
Yes.
So, you know, when you think of something and you see it happening and you have spent in a lot of effort making it to happen, and the kind of satisfaction you get out of it is much different. I mean, it's a person's temperament.
Yes.
So, for example, if you're working in an industry which is only into production, then there are people who work there, but, you know, their job is much different than from the people working in industries who are also have a research as a part of their unit.
Yes.
And if you're working in research labs, then the situation becomes completely different because you are able to express yourself in many ways and at the same time get satisfaction.
That's right. It's kind of a creativity.
Yeah.
I mean, and we'd speak of artists being creative, but you have to be creative to do these research and think of new ways to approach things. And then, as you say, I think one thing that reminds me of is it's almost like, it could be like an addiction. It's a very good feeling, you know, like when you have that epiphany or you discover something new, you're kind of bathed in a good feeling sometimes.
It is like, you know, if you love a job, then you live with it.
Right.
It's like that. So in research, if you start living research, then it's like morning. I mean, for me, when morning when I get up, first thought comes to me is, oh, what is new that I'm going to do today in the lab or in terms of the experiment or the theory or interaction with students and things like that.
Yes.
So basically, if you start living your passion, then obviously you will enjoy your work and you will be, you know, satisfied at the end of the career. So that's how it is. And that's how I have tried to pursue myself. And we'll see where we go.
Wonderful. And thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Agreeing to this interview. It was lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.